Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Douglas, is it Rumpke?
Rumpke.
Okay, if you were up in my territory, you'd be pronounced Rumpke, so that's all. Rumpke, okay. And versus Glenn Brenner, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. John Nooney and Mr. Robert Galbraith, attorneys from Rapid City. And let's see, Mr. Nooney, you'll be doing the 20 minutes, and then Mr. Galbraith, the 10-minute rebuttal. Okay, thank you. And then for the appellee, we have Mr. Michael Hickey and Ms. Sarah Baranhui. And Mr. Hickey, I understand you'll be presenting this morning.
That's correct.
Very well. Justice Lori Wilbur has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Scott Myron, a circuit judge in the Fifth Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Wilbur's place. With that, Mr. Nooney, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Please the court, Mr. Hickey, excuse me. Today, I am here today on behalf of Mr. Doug Rumsa, along with my co-counsel, Rob Galbraith. This case is a case before the South Dakota Supreme Court after a decision by the trial court of the Honorable Retired Chief Justice Miller entered a decision granting summary judgment in favor of the defendant, Mr. Brenner, in this case. This case concerns a matter involving alienation affection, which is not something new before this court, as this court has had a number of decisions before concerning that matter. I think it's important that we, as I begin to review the facts of this case and how the case got to the court, that we remember what former Justice Miller said in his decision. He found that the former Ms. Rumsa had no affections to alienate as it concerned my client, Doug Rumsa, and as such, as a matter of law, decided that this case should be dismissed. However, if you look at the facts in a light most favorable to my client, I think it's eminently clear that there certainly were questions of fact that were to be decided by a jury in this matter. And all due respect to Chief Justice Miller, that he incorrectly applied the laws that exist in South Dakota in granting that motion for summary judgment. Some salient facts. The Rumsas were married in 1990. As a young couple, they resided in Michigan. In 1999, Ms. Rumsa alleges in her deposition testimony in this case that she knew in 1999 that she had no affections for my client and that a divorce was imminent in their marriage. It was 9 years into their marriage, more than 10 years before she actually ever filed for a divorce. In 2000, as this court has recognized, and I think in the Fedir case, we must look at circumstantial evidence to take a look at what someone really thought at the time period that were relevant to the issues before the court. In 2000, on the 10th anniversary of Doug and Kelly Rumsa, Kelly Rumsa offered a card to my client, which said something to this effect: "To my wonderful husband, for the best 10 years of my life." This is in 2000. A year after she alleges in her deposition testimony that she knew it was imminent that the party was going to be getting divorced. In 2002, the couple uprooted themselves and moved to Rapid City, South Dakota. At that time, the Rumsas had the occasion to meet then Mr. and Mrs. Brenner and began a friendship with that couple. In about 2005, Glenn and Christy Brenner went through divorce proceedings, and about that time, the friendship that existed between Mr. Brenner and the then Ms. Rumsa seemed to begin to evolve. During the course of discovering this matter, we did obtain the telephonic records, or the cell phone records, I should say, of Mr. Brenner and Ms. Rumsa, and were able to ascertain that from the period of April of 2008 up until November of 2009, we're able to chronicle the calls that occurred between the two of them. And as we pointed out in our brief on more than one occasion, for a number of reasons, on average, Mr. Brenner would call Kelly Rumsa, the wife of my then client, 2.5 times a day. And there were times there were more, almost 1,200 minutes of calls between these two individuals.
For summary judgment, don't we just about have to assume that Mr. Brenner alienated or attempted to alienate, but isn't the real focus here as to whether there were any affections to alienate?
Chief Justice Gilbert, I think this court has talked about that, and there's been a number of decisions, including one that you authored in 1990, the Vidir decision, talked about that exact issue. But when you look at the facts, as the court talked about in Vidir, in a light most favorable to my client, I think it's eminently clear that there were affections to alienate. Look at the card in 2000. Then we'd have the involvement that begins with Mr. Brenner, perhaps maybe just as a friendship has developed. Mr. Brenner finalizes the divorce in 2005. And then we look at a series of events which happened after that. There are things such as breast augmentation surgery that Ms. Rumsa says, well, I did that to put for my husband. I did that for my husband. Now, if one doesn't have any affection for someone, one must ask themselves, why would you go through a cosmetic surgery procedure like that? She had a picture taken of herself, scantily clad in a bikini, and said to her husband, would you please put this up in your office? That was about 2007. The couple went through some marital counseling, which is not uncommon in the world that we live in today. And Colleen Waxler said when she saw them a couple times in 05 and 06, she made specific progress notes about how the marriage between the couple had continued, had moved forward, and had prospered. Pat Karn in 2008 made a comment when he asked Kelly Rumsa specifically, Kelly, do you love your husband? Yes, I do. So if you look at those type, that circumstantial evidence, or the evidence that existed at the time, in relation to what Ms. Rumsa testified to in her deposition, and which I think which ultimately was the springboard for Chief Justice Miller, former Chief Justice Miller, to say there was no affections to alienate. If you look at the facts in a light most favorable to my client, I think it's imminently clear that she had to have some affections from the card, the surgery, the trips, and things such as that. For instance, the divorce was filed in this matter October 6th of 2009. The trial court found there were no affections to alienate. In April of 2009, approximately 6 months before the divorce was filed in this matter, and before she began her sexual relationship with Mr. Brenner, the Rumsa family took a family trip to Hawaii. Upon the return of that trip, Ms. Rumsa said to Donna Schmidt, Don Usman, we had the time of our lives. That is going to become an annual family affair for us. We had that much fun. And you say to yourself, the trial court finds there's no affections to alienate in this case. But from 2000, from the time of the card, up until 6 months before the divorce was filed in these proceedings, Ms. Rumsa is telling friends, before the divorce is filed, about what a wonderful time the family had on the trip and how that's going to become an annual event for their family. It isn't as though Mr. Brenner had to embark upon the path of alienating affections. This court has clearly said in prior decisions that doesn't have to be the initial purpose for which the actions ultimately evolved into. But if you look at what happened after April of 2009, in July of 2009, remember, this people had talked on the phone 75 times a month. At not one time had Ms. Rumsa ever suggested to Mr. Brenner of any failings or problems in their marriage. In late July of 2009, Mr. Brenner secures a hotel, a junior suite at a hotel facility in Rapid City, South Dakota. Now, if that doesn't speak volumes to what Mr. Brenner's ultimate intentions were, I don't know what does. Because he even testified, well, I recognized that the potential for intimacy certainly existed that evening. Now, if he wanted to have a conversation with a soccer mom friend of his, it would seem to me that a McDonald's, a Starbucks, a Bully Blends, whatever it may be a more proper venue for such an event. But to suggest to a woman that you know is married, whose husband's out of town, who you don't want to be seen in public with her, that it's proper to go to a motel with one bed and to spend the night with that individual, that speaks volumes to what Mr. Brenner's ultimate intentions were. And then, as you play the come forward then to Labor Day of 2009, again now less than 6 months from the time that Kelly Rumsa had espoused to all of her friends about what a great time she and her family and husband had on this trip, Mr. Brenner says, well, Ms. Rumsa told me that she was getting divorced, although I know she'd still be living in the marital home. So he plans a trip over to near Buffalo, Wyoming, rents a motel room, pulls his boat hundreds of miles to spend time with a woman that he knows is still married. Now, it's questionable whether or not she's filed for a divorce, but he knows that this woman is still married. They have an intimate relationship at that time, and from that time forward, things just continue to evolve. You go forward, October 6th of 2009, the divorce proceedings are actually filed. Mr. Brenner talks about having intimate relationships with Ms. Rumsa off of Mount Rushmore Road in Rapid City, South Dakota. Well, he knows she's still married, she's still living in the marital residence, and the actions that he took relative to these matters, I think, speaks volumes of what his ultimate intentions were.
Well, Chief Justice Miller didn't make a decision based on his intentions, though, did he?
He made a decision, I think, Chief Justice, solely on the position that he said, I don't believe she had any affections to alienate. But I think if you look at the facts, as this court has clearly said in Vadir, and all summary judgment cases, because really at the end of the day, this is just a summary judgment case, the alienation of affection makes it a little bit more interesting to the press, perhaps. But in reality, it's just a summary judgment case. Summary judgment cases, you must take all facts in a light most favorable to the non-movement. And when you do that, but for the following, Kelly Rumsa said, I didn't have any affections from him. I knew I divorced him in 1999. If you take that in a vacuum and you look at the totality of the facts which came up after the 1990 event, it's eminently clear that that fact really can't be supported. In essence, what Kelly Rumsa did in this case is they went back and read this. I'm going to suggest that someone read the Pancras decision and said, well, if she doesn't have any affection to alienate, then I guess there can't be a cause of action. But the facts in this case just really don't support it.
Do you see any distinguishment between summary judgment where it's an intentional tort versus a negligent one? Because clearly this is an intentional tort, if it exists. It's not negligent alienation of affection.
But it's still the question of whether or not what someone's intention was or whether or not they're negligent. It still, I think, involves the same questions of fact that if you take all those facts and you put them in a light most favorable to my client, I don't think there's any real dispute about what happened here. Is Mr. Brenner set off upon a path. Ms. Rumsa wants you to believe that she never had any affection for this individual. In essence, what the argument that was successful to Justice Miller was, well, if I said I didn't intend to do it, or if I didn't have any affections, that is the most self-serving testimony in the world, because Ms. Rumsa assisted Mr. Brenner in the preparation of answers to interrogatories. And we specifically asked them in the question, in one of the interrogatories, identify all of those individuals that will substantiate your claim that you didn't have any affections for Mr. Rumsa. They identified 14 individuals. We took the depositions of 10 of those individuals. We didn't take the deposition of some of the husbands of the wives that we took. And what did we learn from that? Of the 10 people we deposed, and of the 14 people they identified, only 2 people had any suggestion that there was any problems in this marriage and that she didn't have any affections for her husband. One was her divorce attorney, Patricia Meyer, an attorney in Rapid City, South Dakota. Now, Ms. Meyer would have nothing more than secondhand evidence or hearsay evidence after the filing of the divorce proceedings. It would have no firsthand knowledge at all. The other one was a sister of hers. And as we took the sister's deposition, the sister said, well, Kelly and I only talk maybe once or twice a year. We don't really have much of a relationship. And then she went off in some tale about how her sister had complained about a lack of intimacy in her relationship, but during the time they were staying at their home, she walked in upon them upon an intimate moment. So if you look at the facts, I think it's really clear that the people that Ms. Rumsa suggested were going to support her claim that there was no affection alien in this case just cannot substantiate it. Because if you accept that premise, you basically write the alienation of affection laws out of the state of South Dakota. Because all someone has to say is, well, I never loved the person. That was discussed in Vadir. And Vadir clearly said, it's not surprising that somebody would take that position, particularly in a case like this where Ms. Rumsa ultimately then married Mr. Brenner. But it's real clear that if that person, the person that is in the middle of this situation, only has to say, well, I never loved him, so how could you alienate my affections? You basically write the laws of alienation and affection outside. You abrogate them, in essence, is what you do. And I think that if you look at the facts in this case, it is eminently clear that that It cannot be supported by the facts, particularly when you look at them in a light most favorable to my client.
So alienation of affection, the specific intent to alienate affection, mm-hmm. is that different from enticement? Because the evidence you have of Mr. Brenner's conduct is enticement. And as I understand the law, you have to also show that he had the specific intent to destroy the relationship.
Well, he had to have the intent at some time, Justice Cunningham, to alienate the affections of Ms. Rumsfeld from her husband. And I think if you look at the course of action from 1999 up to 2009, there's a myriad of facts which support the fact that there was affections in that relationship. And that the actions that Mr. Brenner took, be it in the beginning in 2005 or as it got more heated in 2009, became eminently clear that he was pulling her, enticing her away. If you look at the phone records, I think it's really quite interesting, because in the world that we live in today, we do get a lot of interesting discovery. In August of 2009, before the sexual relationship had actually developed between this couple, Mr. Brenner had called Kelly Rumsa 94 times.
But what you're describing is enticement. And are you saying then that alienation of affections and enticement are really the same thing? When you entice someone's spouse to go with you, you are then alienating that affection. Is that what you're saying?
I think they are really one and the same thing, because you can alienate and entice, which really can be the same thing, because if you look at what happened here, after that relationship was consummated in a sexual relationship, all of a sudden the calls between these pair fell like by 80%, went from 94 calls in a month to 16 calls. And I don't know how else you really explain that. Maybe it's coincidence, but it sure seems to show a pattern that Mr. Brenner had as he continued to work his relationship. And remember, in July of 2009, whether at the hotel in Rapid City, he said to Kelly, "Well, until you file for divorce, we can't take this relationship any further." I don't know if that's enticement, I don't know if that's alienation, but the action is wrong, as this court has identified. And if you look at the facts in this case, I think it's eminently clear that the trial court erred in its decision to find that there, when you consider the facts in the light most favorable to my client, that there wasn't a cause of action for alienation and affection.
Mr. Nooney, I believe one of your issues was whether there's a reasonable basis to believe there is willful, wanton, malicious conduct, which really goes to punitive damages. And we haven't talked about that at all. Could it be, and Justice Miller didn't say anything about, or didn't have any findings on that, is this an issue where there has to be findings on that issue, or could we end up in this situation where maybe you're right on the alienation of affection, but there's no punitive damages?
Well,
that's a possibility in this case.
Mr. Severson, that's exactly where I was going next. I have to touch on the issue of punitive damages, obviously. Court has been very clear in the past on the question of whether or not a punitive damage discovery is appropriate, that all that has to be established is a reasonable basis to believe. Now, that's a pretty broad spectrum as to what that standard would be. And if you're going to have a tort is going to proceed forward to trial, an intent towards such as alienation and affection, it is inherently necessary then that there has to be a punitive damage discovery, because you can't have a cause of action going forward on alienation of affection or any intentional tort without there being the underlying right to do the discovery on the punitive damage claim, because they are intertwined. You can't have one without the other. And in this case, Justice Miller made the decision that there wasn't any claim for punitive damages, which was, for all the respect, the writing on the wall to me, that I knew the summary judgment was going to come down the way that it did, because you can't have one without the other. And if you have a cause of action that goes forward, if this court makes a determination that Justice Miller erred in his decision in granting the motion for summary judgment, it then goes necessarily also that you have to allow the discovery for punitive damages in this case, because they really are intertwined. You can't have one without the other. If you look at the law of this state, and we can talk about alienation and affection cases, but I think in the end, we really just need to look at this case as a summary judgment case. In this case, this court has written a number of decisions. In fact, one that was recently published last week that talked about factual questions involving issues that are factually driven. And at the end of the day, this case, it's very clear that there's a lot of facts out there that 12 jurors in Pennington County are entitled to hear about. And Justice Miller's decision, or the trial court's decision, that there wasn't a factual basis to suggest there was any alienate, you could not alienate the affection of Ms. Rumsa, is unfounded. because the circumstantial evidence that was before Justice Miller is eminently clear that from 2000 up to 2009, that there were a lot of facts and circumstantial evidence which certainly supported the fact that there were affections to be alienated, and the actions of Mr. Brenner up through 2009 clearly alienated those affections, giving a cause of action to my client. And if you find that the summary judgment was inappropriate, with all due respect to the trial judge, the punitive damage discovery must be allowed to go forward. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Noonan. Hey, Mr. Hickey, you have 20 minutes, sir.
My name is Michael Hickey. Sarah and I, Sarah Baron Hoogan, and I represent Glenn Brenner in this litigation. I want to go directly to the basis upon which Judge Miller ruled in this case, that is, that there were no alienations of affections between Kelly for her husband, Doug. I think that's the critical issue in this case. When you look at the principles of summary judgment, as this court has earlier enunciated, the non-moving party, in order to avoid summary judgment, must come forward with specific facts showing that there is a disputed issue of a genuine issue of a material fact. Okay? That's the standard that this court has in the past expressed. Let's talk about whether or not Kelly had affections for Doug.
So you've got to pretty well concede, because of summary judgment, that your client did intend to alienate.
No, Your Honor, I don't think Justice Miller even got to that point.
But this is summary judgment.
But I think if there are no disputed facts on any particular element, the case is over. Judge Miller, I think, in his decision, indicated that there were no affections to alienate. I don't think he went any further than that. I don't want to sit here and concede that Glenn Brenner intentionally did anything, because I don't believe he did. But again, I don't think that was the basis upon which Judge Miller made his decision.
We do have some summary judgment cases, alienation cases from time to time. Have any of them previously been disposed by summary judgment?
The only one I'm familiar, yeah, I think that recently one you summarily affirmed, I think it's the Fisher case, for example, out of Rapid City. I think that was a summary judgment by Judge Davis, which this court summarily affirmed. And the only reason I know about it is because Justice Miller wrote it in his opinion that he had referred to it. So I do think there are cases out there that summary judgment is appropriate.
Yes.
And also in the Pankratz case, for example, in that case, if you recall, the court actually reversed the decision of the trial court, holding that based upon the evidence that was presented, the trial court erred in awarding $10,000 of damages. So I do think that there is precedent out there where the court, as a matter of law, determines that there are no affections to alienate.
You know, Mr. Hickey, when I look at the opposition to the defendant's statement of undisputed facts, and I see things like the marital relationship was well above average, exceptionally good. Waxel reports they expressed love to each other. Kelly reported to Karn in 2008 that she loved Doug. And I'm not going to go through it all, but you go right down this list. How can you say that with those facts that there isn't a question of fact for the jury here?
Easy, Your Honor. Doug Rumsa saying we had an above-average marriage, we had an exceptional marriage, that's his perspective of it. It's not Kelly Rumska's perspective of it.
But isn't the jury? The jury's got to look at both people's testimony.
No, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree with that. It is Kelly's affections that are at issue. It's not somebody else's. Under your summary judgment standard, the specific facts that somebody has to come forward with to defeat it is it can't be based on speculation. It can't be unsupported statements. Doug Rumska saying, "We had an exceptional marriage," for example, that's like me saying, "I know what you're thinking. I know what you're feeling." You can't do that. That's not admissible.
Well, are you saying then that that Kelly is the only one that could produce
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. Kelly is the only one who knows whether or not she had affections for her husband.
And so no other evidence is relevant to
that. I think it may be relevant, but I don't think it's very relevant. If you look at Pankratz, for example, and if you look at Veeder, in Veeder, the first time the husband said, I knew that there was a problem in the marriage was when he found out about the affair. And in that case, there was evidence that Mrs. Veeder actually wrote letters during the divorce proceeding telling her husband, I want my old life back. I would do anything to get my old life back. You know, she recanted the fact that she didn't have affections for her husband. I think that creates an issue of fact.
But here we have, forward. In this opposition, Kelly is reporting to Pat Carn that she loved Doug in 2008.
Your Honor, I don't think that's admissible because I think that's a hearsay statement. And if you read Kelly's deposition, she said that's not the way that went down. That was not the way that happened. That was not the way the question was framed. And if you look at her testimony, and if you look at the testimony of Doug Rumska, for example, she testified that she had no affections for her husband for a number of reasons. He physically abused her. He emotionally abused her. He was controlling. He was unhappy with her in every aspect of her life. And to Doug Rumska, that's an exceptional marriage. But to Kelly Rumska, Kelly Brenner, it was not. And she's entitled to have those feelings. She's entitled to make those decisions for herself. And basically what you're doing here, if you adopt the rationale that Mr. Rumska is asking you to adopt, you're converting Kelly's feelings, Kelly's subjective belief, her attitude towards her husband into an objective standard that a jury gets to sit in judgment and say, well, you know, as a juror, if you only hit her once, it's okay. If you know, some jurors could say he can hit her once. Some jurors could say he can hit her 12 times.
So then,
that's the standard? It can't be, Your Honor.
So then the cause of action is never going to survive summary judgment unless the person who was alienated expressly admits that I still love my husband.
I think that's where you end up, Your Honor. I think that it's that critical that if that person says, under oath, I had no affections to alienate, as Kelly Rumska has repeatedly said, as Kelly Rumska told her husband on a repeated occasion, I do not love you, I do not have affections for you, I want a divorce, he's admitted that. He's admitted those conversations. And as I recall this court on previous occasions, they have said that you can't claim a better version of the facts than that supported by your own evidence, by your own testimony. And that's exactly what we have here. She told him, she communicated to him a number of times. He acknowledged it. He agreed with it, that's what she had told him. I think that is telling, Your Honor. This is not a case like Veeder at all. Kelly did not have affections, and she listed all of the reasons why. Now, in response to that, the plaintiffs have attempted to show, well, Doug Rumska said they had an exceptional marriage. That's speculation. That's not Kelly's feelings. The neighbors expressed surprise that the Rumskas filed divorce. Again, that's speculation. That shows their feelings about that marriage, not Kelly Rumska's feelings about that marriage. If you look at the testimony of Chris Legner, for example, you know, he obviously had a relationship with Kelly Rumska long before Glenn Brenner got involved in this matter. You know, he lied in his deposition. He said it was purely platonic. And then afterwards, he changed his answer from no to yes and admitted that they had a romantic relationship. And that's one of the people that the plaintiffs rely upon to create a issue of fact. This case is really simple, Your Honor. I mean, all you need to do is look at Kelly Rumska's consistent testimony with respect to whether or not she had affections for her husband, and she gave you the reasons why she did not. And I think there are a number of misstatements in the brief of Mr. Rumstead, for example. This business about 1999, she made up her mind to have to get a divorce in 1999. If you read her deposition, I think it's, I can't remember the page, she said she knew that she was going to get a divorce at some point in time, not that she was going to be divorced by 1999. When they moved to Rapid City and they were looking at houses, the house that they were actually looking at was available because of the divorce. And she thought to herself, you know, this is going to be me someday. I'm not sure when. I'm going to try to stick it out for the benefit of the kids, but I'm going to get divorced. I'm not going to live like this. And justices, she has the right to do that. She's not a piece of property. She's not owned by Doug Rumska. I understand this court has previously said that that's a function of the legislature, but I think in applying this case and the facts of this case, there has to be some evidence by Kelly Rumska that she continued to have affections to alienate. And I respectfully submit there is not, based upon her testimony. Judge Miller said it's definite, it's clear, it's consistent, reasonable. In essence, he said reasonable minds cannot differ when it comes to Kelly's feelings for her husband. And I would submit to you that that's absolutely clear, because only she knows. Only she knows. Other people can speculate, other people can guess, but only she knows. And she testified that she had no affections. I know it's kind of intertwined with the intentional acts and things like that, and I think if you look at the facts, for example, there's a lot of phone calls. The plaintiff would have you speculate that that's the basis of Mr. Brenner attempting to entice or seduce Kelly Brenner. She was a willing participant in those phone calls. She made nearly as many phone calls to Mr. Brenner as Mr. Brenner made to her. That's very similar to her conduct with Chris Legner. There are numerous phone calls. This lady spent a lot of time on the phone, and I think that demonstrates her unhappiness in her marriage. She told Chris Legner that she was not happy. She told her sister that she was not happy. I don't think that it's required that when a woman is struggling in a marriage that she needs to take out a billboard, or she needs to send a letter or go to her friends and express to them how unhappy she is. I think that's a personal decision that she's entitled to make. And that's what she did. She got out of an abusive, emotionally and physically abusive relationship, and she's in a new relationship with somebody she loves. And she's entitled to do that, Your Honor.
You know, again, I agree with what you said. But the problem for me is this is summary judgment. And when I read the trial court's decision, and the court necessarily says that the evidence on one side is overwhelmingly rebutted by Kelly, I mean, the flags go off about summary judgment when you see language like, the evidence is rebutted. That's just not consistent with summary judgment.
I think those are the words that Judge Miller used. Okay, I don't dispute that. But I think he correctly applied the law, because it's Kelly's subjective belief, her feelings, that's the second element. And it doesn't matter what Doug Rumska may think about that. It doesn't matter what the neighbors may think about that. It's Kelly. And I'm not going to sit here and, you know, it's, you know, a marriage is a difficult thing, okay? There's probably peaks and valleys in it, I would guess. And isn't she entitled to have those feelings? And to allow a jury, when you've got testimony that's credible, testimony that's consistent, that she had no affections, to allow a jury or this court to sit in judgment and say, no, Kelly, we don't think that's enough. We think that 12 people get to decide whether or not you had affections. We don't care what you said. We don't care how you feel. That can't be the law. And I think it's as simple as the court just clarifying that that second element of affections is a subjective element. And I think that's what Justice Miller looked at and decided, because that's her testimony. I want to briefly respond, if I can, to the reasonable basis discussion on punitive damages. I don't know, in all candor, whether or not findings are necessary or required on that. I mean, I didn't, in my review of the case law, I couldn't see any place where the court specifically made a direction that findings were necessary when the court enters an order like that. I know we did submit findings, both sides did submit findings to Judge Miller, and ultimately Judge Miller rejected all findings and just signed the order holding that there was no reasonable basis to believe that there was malicious or willful or wanton conduct on the part of the defendant. I do think, however, Your Honor, that there is a difference if, for example, the court decided, and I don't think you should, to remand this, I do think that the punitive damages could be thrown out anyway, because I do think that there are different standards there. But to be perfectly candid, I don't know what the rule is in terms of whether or not findings are necessary on that.
You said that Justice Miller did not reach the question of specific intent to alienate.
Right.
Are we able to examine that?
I think you can examine everything to know. As I understand it, this court has the ability to examine the record independently of Judge Miller's decision.
All right. So what's your argument on that?
Well, I think on the specific intent, I think you need to look at a couple of things. Again, you have Kelly's testimony that's unrefuted that she pursued Mr. Brenner. You have Kelly's testimony that she was the one who wanted to see Mr. Brenner in July, and she called, contacted him, and asked him if she could come over to his house. And she asked him if he would come to her house. And he said, no, I don't think that's appropriate. And that's what led to the getting of the hotel room. And nothing happened in that hotel room. It was Kelly who basically told or did tell Mr. Brenner that she had already filed for divorce, which led to the Labor Day sexual encounter between them. And so clearly she was the pursuer, she was the aggressor, and that's consistent with her belief that she was unhappy. That's consistent with her whole approach to Chris Legner, for example. You know, she was the one that was going to his house. She was the one that was taking food over to him. She was the one that was engaged in an intimate relationship with him. And I think the two fit together, Your Honor, in that respect. That it doesn't, you know, it doesn't show that Glenn was pursuing her. It shows that Kelly wanted to be pursued and was very aggressive in terms of her attachment or her desire to be with Glenn Brenner. She's, you know, I think our court has earlier said, quoting a Minnesota case, that women can find somebody or a spouse can find somebody that's more attractive, that treats them better, that's more financially stable. Lots of other reasons why somebody can be attracted to somebody. And as I understand the law, she's entitled to make that decision if that's something that she chooses to do, if she thinks that's in her own best interest. And I think that's exactly what happened here. Kelly decided that, you know, that she did not want to be married to Doug Rumsky anymore. And is her conduct beyond reproach? No. You know, could she have done it better? Probably. But that's not the standard. And so I think the evidence clearly supports a finding of no intention on the part of Mr. Brenner. I understand the public policy reasons behind the alienations of affections law, and as much as I think it can be abused, I understand that it's to protect a marriage. But it's to protect a marriage where there are actually affections. has no application in a case like this. In a case like this, the alienations of affection is just a vindictive weapon to get back at your former spouse, to get back at the person that she has chosen to be with. And I don't think the court should sanction that. If the court wants to protect a marriage, I would ask this court to protect the marriage of Glenn and Kelly Brenner. That's the marriage that she voluntarily decided that she wanted to enter into. That's the marriage that she has with somebody she cares about and she loves. That's the marriage that should be protected. Not a marriage where somebody has physically and emotionally abused somebody to the extent that they no longer care for that person, they want to get out of that marriage. And so we would respectfully ask this court to affirm the decision of Judge Miller. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Mr. Galbraith, you have 10 minutes, sir. May it please the court, counsel. With all due respect to former Chief Justice Miller and Mr. Hickey, absolute deference has been given to Kelly Rumsa's testimony in this matter. Because Kelly Rumsa has testified there were no affections beginning in 1999, we should ignore all of the evidence since that time to the contrary. We're not asking this court to adopt a new standard. This court said in Veter that there were affections can be drawn from letters or cards. Court further looks to the testimony of family and friends. The card in 2000, these have been the best 10 years of my life. I'm so blessed to have you for my husband. In 2005 and 2006, Kelly Rumsa herself reported to Colleen Waxler. They were communicating effectively and expressing love to each other. In 2008, Kelly Rumsa told Pat Carn she loved Doug. And in 2009, Kelly Rumsa told a couple of her closest friends that she thoroughly enjoyed a family vacation and was going to make it an annual event. There's just no basis under South Dakota law to suggest that this absolute deference has to be given to Kelly Rumsa's testimony. Credibility determinations are not made at the summary judgment level. Chris Legner testified that there weren't many problems in the relationship that he knew about, and if there were any, they'd been resolved. One of Kelly Rumsa's closest friends, Amy Jones, testified they may have had a problem, but it was resolved. Another friend, Don Utzman, was completely shocked at the Rumsa divorce. The people around Doug and Kelly Rumsa saw this as a good marriage, including Doug Rumsa. He testified it was exceptionally good. So, Mr. Galbraith, Mr. Hickey indicated this should be a subjective determination, or subjectively, whether or not Kelly had affections. Do you agree that this is subjective, or is it? Are you trying to turn it into an objective test?
I don't know that it's necessarily subjective, but even if it were, I think Kelly's subjective feelings are shown through cards and testimony of friends and family, in her own statements to Colleen Waxler and to her friends and to Pat Carn. If we go back and we look at the Veter case, in that case, the spouse had told friends and family, I'm not happy in my marriage. If you look at the Jones v. Swanson case, it's an Eighth Circuit case, but it interprets South Dakota law. That marriage was wrought with problems. She was found in a bed with another man. She'd told people that the marriage was not great. They went through counseling after she'd moved out of the residence and moved back into it. The court there decided, and the court in Veter decided, this is still a jury question on whether or not there are affections to alienate. Moving briefly to then the reason and the purpose for the alienation, I think, Justice Koningkamp, that the intent to alienate and the intent to entice is essentially one and the same thing. by alienating the, by enticing the affections of Kelly Rumpf, and Mr. Brenner was also alienating those affections from Doug Rumpf, from Kelly Rumpf to Doug Rumpf. So if you look at the phone records, there's really a clear story of Mr. Brenner calling Kelly Rumpf more than Kelly Rumpf called Mr. Brenner. In July of 2004, that is the very latest time that Mr. Brenner knew his actions were enticing Kelly Rumpf's affections, because they shared some intimacy that night. In July of 2004, it's undisputed that he knew. In August of 2004, he called Kelly Rumpf 94 times. For all of the phone records we have, we received in discovery, that's the second highest number of phone calls Mr. Brenner ever placed to Kelly Rumpf. So when he knew his conduct was enticing the affections of Kelly Rumpf, he increased that conduct. In Veter, we talked about maintaining a relationship, and when you maintain a relationship, that gives an inference that the enticement was intentional. We didn't even maintain the relationship in this case. We increased the frequency of the contact. Then it further shows from the phone records that after the relationship was consummated in early September of 2009, the phone calls stopped. They went from 2.5 times a day to only 16 in September. The purpose of these phone calls through the testimony was talking about the children and talking about daily activities in life. That purpose just stopped. If you look and you look at all of the evidence in a light most favorable to our client in this case, there's clearly a question of fact on whether Mr. Brenner intended to entice the affections. His course of conduct, the phone calls, the running, the trips. Mr. Brenner, at the very least, the jury gets to decide whether or not Mr. Brenner intended this. If we look at the question of whether or not the intent question of a reasonable basis to believe whether or not there was malicious conduct, I would submit to the court that if there's a question of fact that the enticement was there and was intentional, that there must be a reasonable basis to believe that there was the malicious conduct. So I would submit to the court that if the summary judgment is reversed, I think punitive damages have to be submitted to the jury and punitive damage discovery has to take place. I want to briefly touch on, I don't necessarily think the findings of fact issue is important. We had actually suggested and argued to former Chief Justice Miller that we thought findings of fact were necessary. And in retrospect, looking at the standard of review this court has, because it was done by deposition testimony, no deference is given to the trial court's determination. So I don't believe that findings of fact are necessary, because I believe you get to look at that as in the first instance here. Finally, we've talked about whether or not Kelly Rumpf told a friend this or told her sister that, or whether or not we just need to focus on Kelly's testimony. We can't go to credibility issues. We have to look at all of the testimony. We look at the circumstantial evidence. If a defendant in a specific intent cause of action were the only person that could testify to the defendant's intent, we would no longer have any specific intent causes of action. But the defendant would be the only one that could say what his intentions were. It's no different in this case. Kelly Rumpf can testify, I love my husband or I didn't. But if all we rely on is her testimony, we're ignoring everything else that's happened surrounding that. And under a summary judgment standard, we simply can't do that. The weight of Kelly Rumpf's testimony will be determined by a jury, but under a summary judgment standard, we have to look at the circumstantial evidence. If we don't look at the circumstantial evidence, there will never be another cause of action for any alienation of affection. There will never be another cause of action for any specific intent crime, because a defendant will simply suggest, I didn't intend to hurt them. I didn't intend to do it. think it all comes back to where we are at, what juncture we are at in this case. If we were up here after a jury trial, the fact that Mr. Hickey has suggested that Mr. Brenner's argument is palpable would be a good argument. But at summary judgment, a palpable argument can't hold up. The evidence is viewed in a light most favorable to Mr. Rumsa. Viewing the evidence in a light most favorable to Mr. Rumsa, there are questions of fact which continue to exist which preclude summary judgment in this case. And we would respectfully ask that the court reverse retired Justice Miller's grant of summary judgment and order denying punitive damage discovery.
Thank you, Mr. Galbraith. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.